The movie The Help continues to rule the box office. It's based on the best-selling novel about an earnest, white, Ole Miss grad who interviews African-American maids in Jackson, Mississippi in 1963 to try to tell the story of what their life is really like. The Help is beloved, but also criticized for glossing over the real dangers blacks would have faced participating in such a project. After all, this was the summer before the summer of 64. Freedom Summer, when 700 volunteers, mostly white middle-class college students organized by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, descended on Mississippi to help register voters and educate kids. At the time, blacks who tried to vote were subjected to tests and taxes, beatings, or worse. Three volunteers, Andrew Goodman, Michael Schwerner, James Cheney, were murdered by America's Taliban, the Ku Klux Klan, on the very first day of that summer-long effort. Other volunteers were sheltered by heroic blacks who sat on porch rockers with shotguns, keeping vigil while their guests slept inside. And the volunteers were led by Bob Moses, a man author Bruce Watson calls the most important civil rights activist Americans have never heard of. We spoke to author Bruce Watson last year and began with that massive effort to bring students in the Freedom Summer. As Bruce reminded us, at that time, SNCC was composed of civil rights workers who'd already done time in Mississippi and had the bullet wounds to show for it. The decision to bring in students caused a lot of dissension.
They had been working in Mississippi for 3 years, working with people, walking around, talking to them, and getting them to come out to the courthouse to register. So this grassroots approach was starting to take effect, and many people in SNCC felt like, well, what's going to happen if we bring 700 volunteers down here just for the summer, and then they're going to be gone? It's going to pull the rug out from the locals. And so there were a lot of long debates into the night about whether or not to do this, but ultimately they went ahead and did it.
And why? What was the thinking?
There had been a couple of murders of black people in which almost nothing had been done. Nothing had been done whatsoever in Mississippi. A white man could get away with killing a black man in Mississippi.
Well, I have to jump in and say, I mean, as you describe it, in broad daylight, white men could chase a black man in a car, corner him in a gas station, for instance, get out and shoot him in front of everybody.
Yeah, my book begins with the murder of Herbert Lee, who was killed in pretty much that way, and the murder was never brought to trial. Worse than that, it made almost no news outside of Mississippi. And so Bob Moses and others felt like something's got to change here. We've got to get the nation's attention. If we do this, we bring 700 people down, we will get the nation's attention, and they did.
Yeah, and we should say, look, we're talking about the 1960s. People in Mississippi today would have every right to say that they have more and maybe even better race relations than, you know, Americans up in the North, for instance. But we're talking about the 60s. Do I go too far in characterizing this violence as America's Taliban?
I do not think you go too far in characterizing the Klan as America's Taliban, although their racism was confined mostly to the South, at least in the 60s, and they had nowhere near the power that the Taliban has. But it was proto-fascist movement designed to preserve the status quo along lines of religion and race, with quite a bit of success in stalling the civil rights movement. The backlash and violence of the Klan in the 60s really had the civil rights movement stalled prior to Freedom Summer.
So uprises SNCC, and the decision is made to train hundreds of these volunteer, largely white students at what was then Western College for Women in Oxford, Ohio. It's now Miami University in Oxford. Tell us a little bit about Bob Moses, the leader, raised in Harlem, Stuyvesant High School, Hamilton College, studied for a doctorate at Harvard, was inspired by the Greensboro lunch counter sit-in to work for Martin Luther King, and then later SNCC.
He went right away into Mississippi on his own when no other black leaders would go there. And there was one amazing incident when he was beaten with a knife handle while he was leading a couple people up the courthouse steps in a town called, believe it or not, Liberty, Mississippi. And rather than turn away, Moses simply got up off the ground, blood streaming down his face. He led the people in to register. And then when he was arrested for this, he pressed charges, something people just simply didn't do in Mississippi. And so that type of icy calm and cool made him a legend in the civil rights movement among those who knew him. And it also quickly drew the attention of the volunteers in Ohio who listened to him speak. Indeed, one said he seemed like the Jesus of the movement. And although he disdained that type of acclaim, he was indeed.
And who were these students?
All but a few were college students, and they came from mostly the better colleges, Harvard, Yale, Oberlin. They came to Ohio thinking they were going off sort of on an adventure, and they quickly met the reality, because these SNCC people, Moses and others, had come up from Mississippi. Many had just come out of jails, and they came and they saw these students, and they were appalled at what seemed like naivete. And they decided, the SNCC people decided, we're simply going to have to tell them the truth. We're going to be sending them into this hellhole. SNCC told these stories of being beaten, jailed, shot at. And they said, quite frankly, to the volunteers, this might happen to you.
Also, there's that one day, a second group of trainees is sitting in an auditorium. They're hearing from Bob Moses and others when someone comes in and whispers in his ear, and he has to come out and tell them what?
Well, he comes out and tells them that three of our people, as he said, went out yesterday to investigate a church burning in Neshoba County in central Mississippi, and they have not come back. And at that moment, a pall passed over the entire auditorium. And you might think at that moment that several would start to reconsider and dozens would go home, and yet only one or two did. The Harvard psychologist Robert Coles was sort of SNCC's staff psychiatrist, and he was there in the Ohio training, and he said it was truly amazing to see idealism conquer the fear and the best in people come out as they reached down in themselves and dedicated themselves to going down there in spite of the dangers and spending the entire summer.
Tell us more about what they did.
Well, I think the most inspiring part of the story was on that same day that the three men disappeared, that morning, the first group of volunteers arrived and in Mississippi and spread out across to their little towns, to the black side of town in every case, because the whites thought they were invaders. They were welcomed with such warmth and genuine earnestness and love. One man said, I've waited 80 years for you to come. And he pressed a dollar bill into the man's hand and said, I pray for your safety every night, son. God bless you all. So that was one of the major responsibilities of the white volunteers, to just be there and to flaunt the Jim Crow tactics. But they're also there to teach in freedom schools, these makeshift schools that they set up to teach black history, black literature, things their public schools would never teach, and to register voters, of course. Take them down to the courthouse, teach them what they would need to know to try to pass the very draconian test that Mississippi had imposed on black voting. So all of those things were a part of Freedom Summer.
Yeah, but as you say, while they were welcomed by blacks, whites were enraged. Some of the students and the families sheltering them that were firebombed, the offices that they built as they went from, you know, to different towns were firebombed, shot at. But as that's happening, how is this coming out of Mississippi?
Well, once the disappearance happened, and as we mentioned, it happened on the first night, it took about 24 hours for the news to reach America, and Walter Cronkite himself read it on the news that following night that three men had disappeared, and from that moment on, all eyes were on Mississippi for the rest of the summer.
Bruce Watson's book about that summer of 1964 is called Freedom Summer. We're going to have much more. And were you there? Tell us about it at hereandnow.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Bruce Watson. His book is Freedom Summer. It's about the efforts of Bob Moses and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, to register blacks in Mississippi in the summer of 64. Now, despite former Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour's recent comments that he doesn't remember race relations being that bad in the 60s in Mississippi, they were, of course, deadly for African Americans. The volunteers who came to register them ultimately brought a delegation of blacks, called the Freedom Democrats, to the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City at the end of that summer. In an attempt to try to win seats from an outraged all-white Mississippi delegation, former sharecropper Fannie Lou Hamer makes an appeal to be seated, speaking to reporters about her attempts to register, how she was beaten in jail, and ending with this cry.
Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook because our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings in America?
But despite her efforts, the Freedom Democrats didn't get their delegation seated. Instead, they were offered a compromise, two seats, which they turned down. As Bruce Watson told us, because of that, many of the Freedom Summer participants felt they'd failed.
They really felt they had gotten almost nothing that they wanted. Very few people had been registered. They'd seen tons of violence. And yet, Freedom Summer was a much greater success over the long run than anyone realized. First of all, it had brought the attention to Mississippi, and it began to bring moderates who'd been cowed into silence out of hiding in Mississippi. They began to finally speak out. But more importantly, during that summer, after he'd signed the Civil Rights Bill, LBJ turned to his Attorney General and said, "I want you to write me the toughest Voting Rights Act you can devise." And so although we often associate the Voting Rights Act with the Selma, Alabama march the following spring, it was really that summer that it began to take effect. In addition, one of the promises that the Freedom Democrats got in Atlantic City when they got those two seats that they didn't care to take was a promise that there would never be another all-white delegation seated at a Democratic National Convention, and there never was. Mm-hmm. And in 1968, Fannie Lou Hamer was a keynote speaker of the Democratic National Convention. And finally, as many volunteers told me, we just thumbed our nose at the Jim Crow system. We just did what we wanted to do in a very upfront way. And that was shocking to Mississippi, but it was very refreshing. It empowered Mississippi blacks. Fannie Lou Hamer said, nobody ever came out in the country and treated black people as real people. She said, they treated us like we were special, these volunteers, and we loved them.
Well, and as you say, some things took time, but they still arrived. The final trial in the Goodman-Cheney-Schwimmer case wasn't until 2005, but it happened. And the instigator of their extermination, as the Ku Klux Klan called it, he was finally convicted. And you write about an activist who years later tells his kids that, you know, we used to have to duck down if we were in an integrated car, you know, and the kids were like, not in Mississippi.
Every volunteer who spoke to me said I was terrified the whole time I was in Mississippi. It was nothing but fear. And yet they learned to walk beside their fears and to go on. Singing helped them a lot. The friendships that they formed with black people, many friendships which last to this day. These were the things that really were the untold story, I thought, of Freedom Summer and something I wanted to get. And also the story of the Freedom Schools. The Freedom Schools were the shining light of Freedom Summer. They had expected about 1,000 students to show up to these makeshift schools in basements and converted shacks, and 2,000 showed up. And they were filled with singing and wonderfully creative exercises and students beginning to open up and learn. And they were also, the Freedom Schools teachers were encouraged to teach black literature. The poetry of Langston Hughes was enormously popular at every Freedom School. One woman said, I remembered reading the novels of Richard Wright in Freedom School. She said, you mean black people can write books? We'd always been told we had done nothing we could be proud of.
You had one teacher asking students where Americans might have come from, and they're guessing England, France, and then the teacher says, what about Africa? And the student says, does that count?
That's a good example of how the Jim Crow system was not just about power or who owned land or who had the right to walk down the street or eat, drink at a drinking fountain. It was really about pride, and it was really about keeping people in their place, keeping them down through humiliation and degradation.
Mario Savio, one of the students, went on to become the leader of Berkeley's free speech movement.
There are other names that people might recognize, Casey Hayden and Mary King, who were SNCC workers who wrote one of the most important early papers in the women's movement. Abby Hoffman didn't work in Freedom Summer, but he worked in Mississippi the year after Freedom Summer. And William Kunstler, who defended Abby Hoffman at the Chicago 7 trial, his daughter was a Freedom Summer volunteer, and he was the lawyer for the Schwerner family during the whole case after Mickey disappeared. So a lot of the roots of all of the 1960s come from Freedom Summer.
Well, and Bob Moses?
Bob Moses went after Freedom Summer. He left Mississippi within a few months, really burned out and amazingly still alive, and drifted around for a while, protested Vietnam, and finally had to leave the country because he was a conscientious objector, but he was got his draft notice. When he came back, he started up at Harvard again, and he got a MacArthur Genius Grant. And he used it to create this amazing program called the Algebra Project, which he's been running now for about almost 30 years. And it works to help inner-city children and students learn algebra, which he knows is a key to success.
Did you ask him? I mean, you could never ask him directly, do you think you should have more of a profile given what you did that summer? But, you know, belatedly, the country embraced Fannie Lou Hamer. Did you ask him how he feels about his anonymity?
I didn't ask, and yet I think he is known for people who know civil rights movement history, know Bob Moses, but no, I think all of SNCC, in a way, has not received the attention that it deserved, and many people in SNCC do feel that way, and yet the road they took, the direction they took, which was grassroots, not looking for big-name leaders, but looking to empower ordinary people, simply demanded that they not take the spotlight. Mm. And I think some people in SNCC feel and resent this, that the civil rights history tends to come down to Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. And yet I think Moses understands that what needed to get done got done through the empowerment of people like Fannie Lou Hamer and hundreds of others who are in this book but whose names are not well known, whose lives were changed by the fighting back of the fear and the rising up to demand their rights.
Bruce Watson's book is Freedom Summer, The Savage Season That Made Mississippi Burn and Made America a Democracy. Bruce, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that is Fannie Lou Hamer leading one of the songs that bound volunteers together that summer. Again, if you were there, a resident, a student, we'd love to hear your story. Go to hereandnow.org. Latest news is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England, and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com. And the Institute of Contemporary Art, Boston, with works by sculptor Ava Hess on view now, icaboston.org.